Shalom leYehudim, shalom leBnei Noach, shalom leGoyim. It's the evening of the second day, Ches B'Tishrei Parashas Ha'azinu, the evening of the first day, Sunday, 9 October 2016, webcasting from the land of Israel that the world community overwhelmingly insists is Palestine of the Palestinians. But first, the daily scorecard. Two more dead Jews, a 60-year-old woman and a 29-year-old just-married heroic policeman who placed himself between the savage and pedestrians in Jerusalem by the light rail Ammunition Hill stop. Not surprisingly, before the day was out, the secular moderate peace-loving Fatah posted its secular opinion that the savage murderer was a holy man, a martyr, shaheed. And never mind the oddity of these secular patriots, nationalists, speaking in such terms. And never mind my doorstopper of a book that records hundreds, I guess, examples of Arab propaganda by Fatah that is couched exclusively in religious terms. And I doubt there are many, like yours truly, who know that the very word Fatah is a chapter title in the Quran. I'll bet the late Mr. Perez did not know that. Not only is the Palestinian national identity a hoax, so is the claim that Fatah represents the secular people among the so-called Palestinians, that too is a hoax. We live in a world of lies in Alma de Shikra. So I guess it's proper that the world leaders are the greatest liars of all, like Obama and Kerry, whose State Department protested last week the new settlement, as a new settlement, the 98 new homes for Jewish families that the government is going to build in Shiloh, even though the government said the construction is within the confines of an existing settlement pre-Oslo, which was given permission by Oslo to live a normal life, which means adding homes within its territory. The Prime Minister's office issued a statement along these lines, but did not point out that the charge was a lie. What it might have done is say, the United States is Israel's best friend, and we believe it has Israel's best interests at heart. So we can only conclude that the U.S. intelligence was faulty, and the administration was fed a lie, which Israel is confident it will want to correct. It really is disheartening when the government in Washington responds as it did, with a lie. Now, political Israel universally observed the State Department's was an unusually harsh criticism, and perhaps that's because the State Department knew it was lying, and the harshness was meant to throw sand in everyone's eyes. Disheartening when any government lies about Jews, my definition of anti-Semitism. Likewise, in Brussels, erstwhile teenage communist Federica Mogherini used the occasion to doubt Israel's commitment to the two-state solution and even to peace. More lying, because this two-state solution is camouflage for the expulsion of Jews on a scale not seen since World War II and far greater than the Great Expulsion from Spain over 500 years ago. And I doubt that tomorrow we will read of similar harsh remarks from Washington and from Brussels, this time directed at Fatah for declaring the savage murderer today a martyr, a hero, a holy man. We'll hear nothing. And make no mistake, he was a savage, a term unfortunately no longer politically correct in the West, thanks to the thought police and the thought policeman in the Oval Office, who, by imperial fiat, declared early in his term that the human mind must never connect Islam with savage murderers. When was the last time you watched a mainstream media newscast in which the anchor person used the term savage to describe these Arab Muslim assassins and suicide cultists, called them savages or barbarians? It used to be a word that gave no trouble to the most liberal and open-minded of Westerners, for example, the principal author of the American Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, patron saint of American liberalism, whose declaration was largely an indictment of the crimes against the American colonists committed by the agents of King George III, one of them being the charge that he had, quote, excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontier, the merciless Indian savages, that's capital I, capital S, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions, close quote. Which I say is as good a definition of terrorism as any today. Jefferson, it should be noted, he had grown up on the frontier himself and knew the Indians well. He knew of their good qualities and virtues, but also of their cruelty. During the rebellion, the crown had indeed been supported by the Indians, who rightly saw in the rebellion American colonists hungry for even more land. Indeed, one reputable historian has suggested that more non-combatant colonists, specifically families, men and women and children, were killed by Indians during the American Revolutionary War than fell as soldiers in battle against the British and Hessian troops. The Indians liked to strike at dawn, when bleary-eyed settlers on the frontier would wake up and go outside to answer nature's call and be pounced upon with their pants down, literally. That was a good time to bash them in the head with a tomahawk. And neither did Thomas Jefferson after the Revolution, when posted to Europe and was faced with hijacking and hostage-taking by Muslims, refrain from calling them savages and barbarians, too. Certainly would be refreshing, a refreshing change for official Israel and all the liberal, nominally free Western liberal democracies to drop the term terrorist, which has become so worn it no longer has any impact. I look forward to the day when the MSM here and everywhere stops calling these murderers terrorists and calls them murderers, calls them savages, calls them homicidal Muslim maniacs. And what also had yours truly today sighing over was the information that today's murderer was, quote, due to turn himself in and begin a four-month jail term after being convicted almost 2 years ago in January 2015 on numerous accounts of inciting to terror and supporting a terror organization, close quote. I say that language has to go. How about inciting to murdering Jews and belonging to a Jew-killing murder cult? In any case, I think Israel needs a spiritual overhaul for treating such men no longer this way. Giving him a four-month sentence for inciting to mass murder, which is what inciting to terror commonly means in practice, what is the point? What is the purpose? To reform him? To deter others? His crime, I think, was posting on his Facebook page praise for Hamas and other terrorist groups and calling for attacks on Israelis. I'm of the opinion that the only true deterrent is expulsion. Such men must be booted from the country with the clothes on their backs as soon as sentence is pronounced. Israel might also tell the outraged, enlightened world when that happens that this is the most humane response, more so than putting him in prison. And why must Israel pay for his room and board in that period? Such criminals must be expelled. The least intelligent thing to do, that Israel should know by now after 23 failed bloody years of Shimon Peres' utopian hostile fantasy, is trying to negotiate with them some amicable deal, some compromise. Fatah not only posted what it did today about this martyr, after the latest slaying of two Jews, quote, they put in, due to the barbaric escalation being created by the occupation government and the herds of settlers, which includes killing, violence, destruction, and an attempt to instill fear in our Palestinian cities, villages, and refugee camps, and particularly in Jerusalem, we announced our complete objection to crimes of these types being carried out before the international community and its human rights organizations. These organizations have not succeeded in forcing the occupation to abide by international law and treat it as an entity that is above international law, close quote. I hope you realize the crimes referred to here are the crimes of killing attackers like this savage this morning. And I say that with such people, negotiation is just plain stupid. And even stranger than anything in Lewis Carroll's Wonderland, how are these bloodthirsty Muslim ghouls accusing Israel of violating international law when these are the same people who brought down the World Trade Center. They're airplane hijackers. They have bombed airplanes, blown them out of the sky. What do they know of international law? Israel has to do a restart, do a reset on how it looks at the Arabs here, these Muslims here, and how to respond to their savagery.
Oh,
Yeah, the international response to the decision to build 98 new homes for Jewish families at Shiloh was as angry as the one in Washington. And Netanyahu yesterday, I believe, tried to explain to Kerry that it was necessary to build these new homes for the families at Emona who are slated to be expelled from their homes come December, to be driven from them because the world insists Judea and Samaria must be Jew-free. Because that is what the ancient Palestinians want. Never mind, the ancient Palestinian desires do not end with this demand. They're completely open about never recognizing the right of Jews to independence in our ancient homeland. In fact, even if Judea and Samaria were to become, from their point of view, blessedly Jew-free, they will still insist that Israel 1949-1967 is their land too. We know this from the maps they produce. Not that Obama and Kerry and Mogherini ever mentioned this. And last Thursday, the anti-Jew New York Times got into the act by siding with the Muslim murderers here in supporting the idea of a Security Council resolution dictating to the Jews what their borders will be. And they, presumably, will be pretty much the 1949 ceasefire line, as the Jew killers insist. The New York Times is a real symbol of the fate of millions of Jews who came to America. Their offspring overwhelmingly do not live Jewish lives. They observe no Sabbath, no dietary discipline. Their children and grandchildren have married non-Jews and thus have left the Jewish people. The New York Times became, so to speak, their Rebbe, their spokesman, and it was the handiwork of German Reform Jews, the Ochs family and the Sulzberger families and the Dreyfus families, who lived according to that template of dissolution over time. Orthodox Jews who become Reformed Jews can expect within 3 to 4 generations to leave the Jewish people altogether. In 1896, the undistinguished at the time New York Times was purchased by Adolf Ochs, who was born in the U.S. to reform German Jews who had fled Germany in mid-century. He himself married a Jewess. Likewise, his son and grandson married Jewesses, but the current publisher, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., had a mother who was an Episcopalian, and so he was raised right on schedule. The fourth generation is the lost generation. And it was never a coincidence that the Times was hostile to the Zionist movement from day one. It couldn't be otherwise because they felt that the movement would cast the slander of dual loyalty on American Jews who supported the movement when they were desperate to be accepted as full-blooded Americans. And so, as the writer Laurel Leff showed some years back in her book entitled Buried by the Times, the New York Times during the Holocaust likewise buried news of that horror. To make mention of it could cast doubt that the publishers cared more about those foreign Jews than their own fellow Americans. The Times is a major source in my book, and consistently it is exposed to be as villainous toward Israel as it was toward the Jews in Europe during the Holocaust. So last Thursday, the Times editorialist advocated the very thing the editorialist knows is the last thing Israel wants. The editorialist called on the MBA, the Muslim Brotherhood agent in the Oval Office, to lead the charge in the Security Council for a resolution laying down guidelines for a peace agreement. In other words, Israel is not allowed to decide its own future. The Security Council will do that for Israel. Admittedly, the probably de-Judaized editorialist wrote, quote, "That may seem like a bureaucratic response, unlikely to change anything. But it is the kind of political pressure Mr. Netanyahu abhors and has been working assiduously to prevent." Yeah, the Times wants action, and the Prime Minister of Israel abhors the action the Times wants, which implies that the Times editorialist believes he and Barack Obama and the Security Council know what's best for Israel, for the allegedly ancient Palestinians, and the world. John Kerry for sure thinks he knows better than Benjamin Netanyahu what is best for Israel. Barack Obama, too. Someday I hope some journalist historian interviews the two of them and asks for their explanation, their understanding of how it came about that they know better what's best for Israel than Israel, Israelis themselves, people who democratically keep electing Netanyahu to lead them. It would be interesting to hear what they have to say about their own superior wisdom and how they came by it. For sure, during the Paris funeral a week ago Friday, the speech delivered by Barack Obama was one subtle insult after another of the prime minister sitting in front of him. All this praise for Perez was couched in such a way as to imply that the current prime minister dishonors him by not acting like him toward the victims of Zionism. What a disgusting spectacle that was. All those foreign dignitaries whose presence was intended to support the pro-Muslim policy that Perez preached. Meanwhile, in New York City, the UN has been planning an informal Security Council session slated for this Friday, called to discuss, quote, this is the title of the meeting, illegal Israeli settlements, colon, obstacles to peace and the two-state solution. This meeting came about at the initiative of Angola, Malaysia, Venezuela, Senegal, and Egypt. Aside from Egypt, one wants to know, what do these states care about the situation here? What business is it of theirs? Are there no issues and problems from closer to home? Venezuela, for sure, may be on the way to becoming the first failed state in the Western Hemisphere. Well, as yours truly has opined before, this is behavior that makes me smile as further proof of the power of Jewishness, the truth of Jewishness, how the world is obsessed with us. You're listening to www.deprogramprogram.com, broadcasting from the hills of Judea. I'm Shai Ben-Tekoa. Well, there was more information that came out about last week's action out of Gaza, the 2 days of missile attacks, and the IDF's plainly intensified response. Military reporters in the MSM here took note of the intensity of the IDF response. That was far greater than anything in the past. This is the new policy under Avigdor Lieberman to hit them harder. But also illuminating was the information that what triggered last week's missile attacks by them and previous ones out of Gaza is the friction between Hamas and a rival Islamist cult, the one responsible for all these recent projectiles. This one is called Aknaf Beit al-Maqdis, meaning supporters of the temple, i.e. the Temple of Suleiman. That's the Arab mangling of Shlomo Solomon. And never mind, as Muslims, they surely teach nothing of what went on in the temple. All they know is that Suleiman was a Muslim, and therefore his temple belongs to them too. Anyways, a few years ago, this Al-Qaeda-type outfit was allied with Hamas in Syria, but then they had a fight, and they broke off, and the other one switched sides. In Gaza last week, those rockets were fired into Sderot as a way of triggering an Israeli response against Hamas. It was a way of getting the IDF to attack their rivals, whom they claim are holding some of their men. And in my book, I reference several incidents in which rival terror groups perpetrate terror against Israel as part of their own rivalry. The hijacking of the Achille Lauro cruise ship was one of them. According to the latest report, this Aknaf is now an ISIS affiliate, though another even smaller group called Al-Fatah al-Sabah has also claimed responsibility for the same rocket. And how reminiscent this is of the 1970s and 80s in Lebanon, and when the PLO ruled the roost and different groups would claim credit for the same action. When they weren't trying to murder Jews, they were also fighting one another in street fights, gang fights. The only difference now is the typology. Back then, the group names were variations on the vocabulary of the FLN in Algeria, the National Liberation Front there. For example, the Palestinian Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, which split. And the new group became the Democratic Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the DPFLP. And then there was the PFLP General Command, and then there was the PLF, the Palestine Liberation Front, and so on and so forth. A dozen, 18 names, all these pseudo-political names. Today, though, with the collapse of the Soviet Union that backed the PFLP, and indeed the left as a whole, the default typology is Islamic. Any way you cut it, it's just this century's transformation of the tribalism at the root of Arab society that they have never outgrown. The Arabs never outgrew their tribalism and rose to a national identity. Witness the collapse of Iraq and Syria, both creations of the West imposed on the subnational groups that didn't work. Witness the 23 years of failure between Hamas and Fatah, both Islamic concepts, to unite and become a unified nation. And there's a connection between this tribalism, which is based basically on bloodlines, and also the connection to the sub-civilized sexual behavior of these sons of Ham and Ishmael. Their sick abuse of women, of boys, girls, men. Likewise, in Gaza, between these smaller Islamist gangs, in the reportage, we learned that in August 2009, when Sheikh Abdelatif Musa, leader of Jund Ansar Allah, another one of these small groups, that means the army of God's disciples, declared that the Gaza Strip was now an Islamic emirate, and he vowed to attack Hamas for failing to enforce Sharia law. This is another chronic feature of life in Arabia. Every ruling group has enemies that want to overthrow it, and the reason is always the same. The rulers are insufficiently pious. As a result of this declaration, Hamas gunmen surrounded the Sheikh's during the very Friday sermon that he announced his emirate, and in the ensuing firefight, he and 23 others were killed, and more than 130 were wounded. That was on their holy day of Friday. This is Gaza, and this would be the fate of Judea and Samaria if Obama, Kerry, Mogherini, and company had their way. Either these people are profoundly ignorant, or they are profoundly anti-Semitic, and striving toward driving Jews from Judea and Samaria in order to turn it all over to these same Muslims, in the belief that this would install peace for Israel, the ancient ones, and the region. Idiots. These are anti-Semitic idiots. Okay, that's it for this Sunday. Tuesday evening, of course, is Kol Nidrei. It's the evening of Yom Kippur, and I'll be back, God willing, on Thursday. Until then, have an easy fast. Laila Tov, Me'eretz Yisrael.